Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a pleasure to welcome you to the first of the LSE Alumni Environmental Initiative Network lecture, which will be given by Herbert Girardet. My name is Richard Burdett, and I'm the director of a new initiative at the LSE, which is called the City Policy, Architecture and Engineering Program, and it falls upon me to act as chairman tonight. And it's a delightful thing to do because I know and admire Herbie, as he's known to his friends and followers, well, and also I applaud the aims of the LSE Environmental Initiative Network, because it's really about creating a greater understanding of the built and the natural environment within the LSE and outside the LSE. And of course, our aims in the new program will be in part about addressing those issues at an interdisciplinary intra-school level. Just a word about the Environmental Initiatives Network and how tonight will work before I introduce Herbie. The network links alumni and friends of the school who share an interest in environmental issues. It was founded during the centennial celebrations a year or two back, and it seeks to highlight environmental concerns and possible solutions, particularly economic solutions. And I think that's very important in terms of what is going to be said tonight. I know Herbert is interested in solutions, just not telling us what the terrible problems of the world are. And again, the network is about enabling alumni and friends of the school to collaborate on environmental projects by using a directory of members listing their interests and areas of expertise. That's a very important aim, by just listing what people are up to in the school, to realize how the environment cuts across a whole range of very diverse interests. There's a plea here on the part of the organizers. Membership costs only £10, and application forms can be collected at the reception in the senior common room immediately after the lecture. Now, the whole point is that you will be invited, all of you, and I hope you will come to the senior common room for a reception afterwards, and you must pick up, of course, the form and become a member immediately. But you're invited anyway to come upstairs. So thank you all for coming, and thank you, of course, Herbert, for taking part and giving this first lecture. The way the evening is going to work is that Herbert will speak for about 45 minutes. We then have about 10 to 15 minutes for questions from the floor, and if you can put up your hand, there are roving microphones, and please wait for the microphone to come to you before you ask your question. Now, turning to the important matter of Herbert Girardet. I mean, really, I can't think of a better person, even though I didn't invite you, because this happened before I arrived, to really talk about environmental issues at the level of a public and political agenda. I think Herbert has done more than most people, certainly in this country, to do that. And I think it's a testimony to, you know, the cross-section of people here in the room tonight that that is the case, that he's been able to have a strong influence not only on academics, but also policymakers at an international level and designers. I'm delighted to see in the room a number of people who I think have share Herbert Girardet's ideas about sustainable development. I think what Herbert has done is extremely wide-ranging, but also extremely focused in terms of looking at solutions, and in particular looking at solutions for cities. There's a great optimism in a subject which tends to bring up great pessimism in the way that Herbert looks at this subject. He feels that by investing, by encouraging where people are, where the opportunities are, where the potential are, in other words, in cities, is where we can in fact find our best solutions. Herbert was brought up in Germany, and he studied anthropology at the LSE. He calls himself a cultural ecologist, a term which comes out very much of his studies here, but he applied his interest in linking culture and nature in the wider sense of the word, not just to primitive societies, but to sort of modern post-industrial society. That's what leads very much the work he's been doing. It's interesting that, in fact, he wrote his first article on the environment, called Socialism and the Environment, for the LSE Socialist newspaper in 1971. That was his first publication ever. And it's his first lecture here tonight. He tells me it's the first time that he's actually lecturing formally here at the LSE. a few final things on a very, very impressive track record for someone who's not just an advisor to the United Nations as a consultant on Habitat, a major organization looking at the future of cities and sustainable development worldwide, globally. He's the author of the Gaia Atlas, probably one of the most influential books in terms of collating statistics on world environment and ecology. But after studying here, he in fact, and this is in a way typical, I think, of you, Herbert, studied at the Courtauld, the School of Art, which is now across the road, but also had a stall on Portobello Road. And I think you will see that there are references to the street, you know, the real culture, what happens down on the street in terms of sort of the grand solutions which he puts forward. He's also been a very successful, very influential filmmaker working with Channel 4, BBC, and done a number of films on the subject of metropolis and similar issues. I think that's more, there's a lot more to say, but I think we should leave everything to Herbert. So could you welcome Herbert Girode? Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Richard. I don't quite recognize myself in all of this praise. I think there's other sides to life that never come out when somebody tries to describe the curriculum vitae of a speaker, such as the darker moments of one's life, the moments when things are not quite as good as they sound when one is introduced. But I haven't been back here for 20 years, over 20 years in fact. The last lecture that I attended here was actually when Sir Ralph Dahrendorf, I think he's now Lord Dahrendorf, gave his introductory lecture. That was a long time ago. It's quite extraordinary, really, that one can come from an alma mater and never go back. It's not a comment on the LSE, it's simply a comment on the fact that I've been on the move rather a lot, as I shall be showing you in some of the slides that I have here. Because when I left the LSE, I got increasingly interested in the story of human impact on the planet, both historically as well as today. And I did have the great privilege and opportunity to look at these issues in a great variety of ways. Soon after leaving the LSE, I worked with the BBC on a series on BBC Two called Far From Paradise, which was actually a history of human impact on the world. And we spent 3 years traveling to many parts of the world, looking at what humanity is doing today, but above all else, what humanity has done in the past. And one of the really memorable moments was filming in Babylon, and seeing a huge pile of rubble surrounded by a salt-encrusted desert. And that was a very salutary experience. I was beginning to ask myself the question, well, if they did that then, I mean, the earliest cities in history, basically creating a shambles around themselves, are we going to do the same thing in modern day, except on a global scale? So this is, I think, a kind of question that I've been trying to ask and trying to find answers to ever since being involved in studying here and then doing that TV series. So what I would like to do this evening is to take you on both a sort of geographical journey, showing you slides that I've taken as I was working as a filmmaker and as a writer and journalist in different parts of the world, whilst at the same time also taking you on a journey through disciplines. I mean, the LSE itself is remarkable in its variety of disciplines, from sociology to economics to politics to geography to anthropology. Now, design, Richard is taking the lead in urban design in the new department that he leads. And I think it's really critical, if we are serious about sustainability, sustainable lifestyles on this planet today, to bring all these disciplines together. We cannot really afford any longer to live in little boxes. It no longer adds up to enough in terms of the overall picture that we need to present ourselves with if we are serious and try to find answers to this collision course that we are on between humanity and the planet. And certainly that is something that we see all over the world, as I shall show you in a minute. Well, much of this actually started in the modern day, that is, in London. London was a city of about 850,000 people in around 1800 and grew tenfold to about 8.5 million people in about 1930. And at that time, it was the fastest growing history in the world. I mean, there was never a city much more than about 1 million people before that. And of course, there were the reasons for its growth, and the two main ones, of course, were access to fossil fuels and access to global resources, partly as a result of that availability of fossil fuels. The steam engine in boats, in ships, in freighters, in trains, pumping stations, in mines and so on, transformed the relationship between humanity and the planet. I think we must really take that as a starting point of so much as what has happened since then. And urbanization as we know it today really got going when London grew in this extraordinary way. Now I just have to work out the practicalities of, there's no light on this console here where I'm supposed to. Advance the slide. Right, here we go. Hong Kong today is a city as rich as London. London has a total, as a study done by the LSE, shown London has a turnover, the city of London that is, of about £90 billion per year. It was about £85 million per year about 3 or 4 years ago. It's now grown to over 90, in fact. Hong Kong, as of last year, I think, exceeded that figure for the first time. So the satellite, in a sense, has overtaken the mother city. Now, Hong Kong, as a place, shows many of the developments that are now happening all over the world. It spawned an extraordinary growth of urbanization right across China. And China is the most phenomenal place at this point in time in terms of urban growth. The Chinese currently have about 630 cities, and by 2010 they expect to have doubled that number. Some 300 million people, currently peasant farmers living in rural areas, are moving into cities, are expected to move into cities by the year 2010. This Christmas, when I went Christmas shopping, I found everywhere the most reasonably priced products, whether they were hi-fis or whether they were cameras or computer peripherals, the one were made in China, and that was a completely new phenomenal development. So as a result of that, China is changing its impact on the environment, its own environment first of all, but beyond that, the global environment. I mean, China as a country has been largely self-sufficient in food until recently, and as a result of this increased wealth, suddenly the Chinese are going up the meat ladder. Now that basically means that suddenly people who are on a largely vegetarian diet with a little bit of sweet and sour pork and so on are suddenly into chunks of meat. Now that means every time you eat a bowl of rice, you have a limited impact on the environment in terms of small acreages of land required to produce it. As soon as you enter meat eating, you enter massive areas of land, about 10 times the size of land required to vegetable protein, for animal protein as compared with vegetable protein. So China, at this point in time, is involved in this amazing journey into urbanization, into consumption, and into massively increasing its impact on the global environment. China today, for instance, China is very deficient of forests. So China is now logging in Siberia, it's logging in Nigeria, and suddenly there are the tentacles of a new consumer way of life stretching across the world. Now it's not surprising in a way, this is a picture taken in Guangdong province, that people living under these types of conditions, above water full of mosquitoes and so on, want new houses, want new lifestyles. So we should not in any way, you know, speak from a sort of position of sitting on a high horse and say, okay, we already urbanized, we already have these lifestyles, why shouldn't everybody else do the same? But the critical issue is, if the world urbanizes in the way that we have done, what are the implications for humanity and beyond that for the rest of the planet? This is São Paulo, one of the largest cities in South America, and it stretches across some about 200,000 hectares. London does about the same, even though São Paulo is much bigger, but we have suburbs, they don't have to the same extent. When you look at the history of London, you can see how much land suburbanization actually took up once people got wealthier and wealthier, and as a result, the urban sprawl that London and then American cities went through took up enormous areas of land. But the issue that I'm particularly interested here is the impact of the resource use of these cities. This is in Moscow, and we see these vast, concrete slab type of buildings, often very badly insulated. So electricity is a given when you move into these kinds of buildings. Once you are in there, you cannot do without electricity. But that electricity, in turn, has to be produced somewhere. Here we have, I shall come back to that subject in a minute, here we have a picture of a squatter camp in Nairobi. And of course the urban agenda has been dominated by concern about these types of social issues. How can we improve people's lot in these types of situations, surrounded by filth, surrounded by disease vectors? And the reality of washing in streams like this is now in the Amazon, it all looks quite romantic, sitting inside a washing machine, as it were. But the reality is that there are creatures in there that want to have a go at you, and the issue really is, how can we achieve a process of urbanization by which, on the one hand, we create healthy and beneficial conditions for people, on the other hand, we can assure minimal impact on the global environment. That really is the critical issue here. This is in Cairo, where a group called the Zabalin are doing the most amazing work recycling much of the rubbish of the city. And it's wonderful in terms of the minimization of the environmental impact of that city, because this compost goes back to the land on the edge of the city and has enormous benefit for keeping it fertile. But of course there are zillions and zillions of flies in that environment. So on the one hand we have resource efficiency, on the other hand we have exposure to diseases. I mean, in Britain and in Europe today, our main concern is no longer how we are exposed to our own filth, but instead the one major issue that is still with us and continues to be a great cause of concern is the impact of air pollution on people as they breathe fumes from motor cars in particular. Now I want to go into another chapter in this talk, which is looking at places such as the Amazon, which are faraway places, and we studied them here, had beautiful experiences looking at the lifestyles of indigenous people. This is in a village in the Amazon called Gorotiri, of a tribe called the Kayapo. And the Kayapo have been at the forefront of trying to stop the further destruction of their forests, have been campaigning vigorously for recognition of their traditional lifestyles. But the reality is that they're exposed to this kind of process. Logging on a gigantic scale is now happening in the Amazon. And this would be of no relevance here unless we can prove and make the connection between that and urban lifestyles. I saw a huge stack of mahogany in Belem Harbour with London stamped on it when I was filming there. This is not London, this is Haysham up north. But nevertheless, the timber from these trees, from these tribal areas, ends up in our backyard or in making window frames, front doors, or being used for pouring concrete in construction sites. This one in Hong Kong, but the timber is certainly Amazonian. You can recognize the color of the mahogany here. Another issue, again, you might say, what has this got to do with urban sustainability? Well, here, one of the haunting experiences I had as a filmmaker was making a film called Halting the Fires, where we looked at the Amazon fires and just tried to understand what caused them to be lit and how they could be prevented in the future. And in one instance, flying through these smoke clouds, you know, you get lost in planes, you can't find the airport any longer and that kind of thing. I mean, I flew over a landscape that was so totally covered with smoke that I spoke to an astronaut who at the same time flew over this in the space shuttle, and the smoke cloud was larger than the entire continent of South America. Now, why is this of relevance? The relevance is that cities, on about 2% of the world's land surface, use about 75% of the world's resources. So what we have had in the past, before humanity, urbanized humanity, impacted on the earth, was basically a distributed system of interaction of different living species with each other, without any kind of center of control, as it were, other than the sun. Maybe God, I don't know, but certainly the sun causing plants to grow and so on. Today we have a highly punctuated system of the cities where half the world's population now live. In the Western world, up to 80-85% of the people now live. And so we have incredible punctuation of lifestyle, with humanity having a monopoly on the entire consumption of fossil fuels, metals, nearly half the world's photosynthetic capacity. So most of that, in fact, is ultimately related to what we do in our cities. This is a mine in the Amazon, a tin mine. In fact, when this place came into use, this is sharp, by the way. Please tell me.
Okay.
If it gets out of focus, please shout so that you can see. It's the called Bom Futuro mine, the mine of the great, beautiful future. And it's a tin mine. And when we went there to film there, we couldn't find the place because there was this enormous forest all around, little roads going through it. And suddenly, turning around the corner, you see this moon landscape inhabited by zillions of trucks and diggers and people with pickaxes. And this particular mine, in fact, replaced the Cornish tin mines as the main supplier of tin to the UK. So again, linkages that we have to understand that are really relevant for conceptualizing what urban sustainability is all about. By the way, Richard said I'm a relatively optimistic guy, and it is true, and even if I've depressed you until this point in time, I can assure you it's not going to just be left at that. I mean, I feel it is critically important to look for solutions, and I shall attempt to do so in the second part of this talk. This is another scene in the Amazon, a metal smelter, an iron smelter, near the town called Marabá. And what's relevant here is that the iron ore which is found nearby, and this incredibly huge mountain called Carajás mine, it's one big mountain which is pure iron ore virtually, is then smelted using tropical forest trees. I mean, the greatest diversity of plants on Earth then ends up being turned into the bodies of motor cars. And again, I don't think we should just feel guilty about this. We should just learn to understand these connections, I believe. And if we do so, we might come up with new decisions that go away and transcend the ones that inform our thinking and our planning at this point in time. Energy is the critical issue, of course, for making cities, modern cities, work. I've never heard of a city of more than 1 million people that did not run on fossil fuels. Here's a huge open cast mine in Germany, of course the causality, the linkages are then from that to the power station, and then we have the problem of acid rain that we have been exposed to in many news stories and many documentaries over the last 15-20 years. A lot has been done, one has to say, to clean up these power stations right across Europe. But still today, about 60% of trees are affected by acid rain damage right across Europe. Now here we are coming to the theme of the ecological footprint of cities. Because cities are concentrations of people in one place, with not that much space in between them usually, they depend on resources from elsewhere, and I've tried to already illustrate that. Here in this instance, the theme is food. Again, there's a massive amount of energy being put into the food production and consumption system, not only in the production on the farm itself, but and on the transport and the motorways, but increasingly food is being flown in to London in this instance from halfway around the world. I had the privilege a couple of years ago of making a film for Channel 4 on London's metabolism. What goes into the city, what comes out the other end. And we filmed at a place called Western International Market just by Heathrow. And there you see this amazing harvest of the world's crops. Now, I love eating everything on there, so, and we all do. So please don't feel that I'm going to try and make us feel guilty here. I'm simply trying to say this food has implications that we need to understand. For instance, we looked at the energy content of an ordinary, humble, beautiful, tasty mango flying in from the Gambia, and we found that by the time it reaches a London kitchen table, it contains about 600 times as much energy as its own calorific value. So 600 to 1 is the kind of ratio for some of this type of food. Or fish from the North Sea. We all know about problems with overfishing in different coastal waters and further out into the oceans. And typically, fish from the North Sea have about 100 times as much energy from deep sea trawling as they actually contain in terms of calorific value. So there's a kind of hidden problem here that we are not prepared to look at. Basically, the problem in economic terms is the underpricing of energy. much of what we are doing worldwide today is as a result of having this incredibly cheap energy available to us. Of course, nature gives it to us at zero cost. And once you've drilled that hole and put that pipe down there to pump out the oil or the gas, it's still at zero cost. The only cost that then arises is, of course, the production, the refining, the transport, and so on. But the reality is that much of the natural resource wealth that we have available to us is really underpriced in terms of the fact that the current activities based on these very cheap prices are not in any way sustainable. So here this is the theme again of the ecological footprint of cities. Now this is a subject that was first raised by a Canadian economist about 4 or 5 years ago. And he said, why don't we try and understand the spatial requirements of feeding cities, supplying them with timber, and also, and most interestingly, of the area required to reabsorb the carbon dioxide output of cities. That is, growing vegetation that would be needed in order to soak up the carbon dioxide that cities, as a result of their use of fossil fuels, spew out from power stations, from the exhaust pipes of motor cars, or indeed from the jet engines of airplanes. And in the case of London, which I studied quite extensively over the last several years, I found that the ecological footprint of this city is roughly the size of the UK. All the fertile land of the UK, the equivalent of that, is required to feed and produce resources for just the one city, which is 12% of Britain's population. Of course, much of that land is in far-flung places, again, like the Amazon or the bean fields of Kenya, or the areas of Assam that supply tea for us, and so on and so forth. So again, it's an issue of understanding these things rather than simply saying, isn't it all terrible? Here, I've tried to quantify what goes into London in terms of resources. Now, I have to emphasize that this is done on the basis of other people's work in most instances, such as the London Research Center, which has done a splendid job on studying the energy supply to London. What I've simply tried to do is translate that into figures that one can understand rather than quantifying it in petajoules, which nobody knows what they are. So the equivalent of London's use of energy is about 20 million tons of oil equivalent, producing in the process of about 60 million tons of carbon dioxide at the bottom there, and various other waste gases, including sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide. All the resources that go into London, including water, in one way or another, require a great deal of additional energy to bring them into the city. And that is really the critical issue for the future. If we are going to run short of fossil fuels, or indeed, if the use of those fossil fuels has an impact on the climate, which just about everybody by now agrees about, then clearly this is a highly unsustainable system, and we need to think about how we might look at it again. And that has led me to think about the metabolism of cities in terms of the way the resources actually flow through these cities. At the top here, you have really how the system works at the present time and how it is being justified by, if you like, conventional economics. You have all these resources that are thought to be necessary to keep an urban lifestyle going: food, water, fuels, goods, various processed goods, timber, pulp, building materials, and outcome various waste materials such as sewage, exhaust gases, various types of solid waste, and then simply wanton disposal. And to my mind, that is a model. If that model is copied worldwide as the basis on which urban development takes place, we are really in stuck in a major way. So in my view, we have to look at another approach to the way we run our cities, which is the one at the bottom here, which is suggesting that we should adopt a more circular metabolism in which to run our cities, and in some ways copying nature's own principles. I mean, if you look at nature, there's no such thing as a waste product. Everything that nature puts out in one way or other is reabsorbed into nature through the roots of trees or plants, through various predators or, some in one way or another. Whatever nature produces always ends up as something useful for another species quite often, sometimes for the same species that is involved in this input-output process itself. And I think in some ways this is the kind of model that we need to look at for how to run our cities in the future, in an age where nearly half the world's people live in cities, and that figure will go up rapidly in the next century. If we have this reality of a human way of life which is so punctuated in the fact that, as I said, 2% of the world's land surface being inhabited by over half the world's people, using about 75% of the resources, that model doesn't work. Definitely doesn't work. Here we have some chance of getting back to, or moving towards, a degree of urban sustainability that allows us to really look with some confidence ahead into the future. But that means a number of things that we are only beginning to do, though, I mean, we are, if you look across the world, there are certainly quite a lot of different cities, in particular traditional towns, one has to say, that are quite aware of this basic principle, which is that if you consume food in cities, in some way you should make sure that the output of that, of our bodies, ends up being turned back into plant nutrients and being returned to the land. At the present time, we have this extraordinary situation of London and other cities consuming food and flushing most of their toilet waste out there somewhere into the North Sea. And I have a nice set of slides here that illustrates this point. I mean, water flows into our cities as a life-giving substance. And again, there's a massive amount of energy required in order to get that water into these places. I mean, here we are in California, traveling through the landscape outside Los Angeles, and there's a huge water pipe there. In fact, it's one of the two objects that can actually be seen from the moon. The Great Wall of China can be seen from the moon, and that water pipeline, because it's just so incredibly long, running all the way from the Colorado River to Los Angeles. And in order to keep that water flowing, there's all kinds of pumping stations. In this one, oh, here we are in London, back in London, Thames Water Control Room. They have it very cleverly sorted out in terms of the sensors that they put into these pipes, you know, making sure that there's enough water going to all the places where it's required, whether it's households or toilets or swimming baths or whatever, hotels. But here are the pumping engines that are required to pump that water around and to pump the sewage back out. And we have to understand that. And really, there's all these hidden systems that we don't see very often in our conventional and happy-go-lucky sort of urban lifestyle. Now, this is a picture of São Paulo. And this is the output that comes out the other end of the metabolism. The stuff that ought to go back to farmland, but it doesn't. And here we have the twin problem of contamination of coastal waters with that stuff, as well as the artificial fertilizers from farmland feeding cities, because typically only half of those are taken up by plant growth. So they both end up polluting coastal waters, of course causing havoc to aquatic life, reducing the capacity of those coastal waters to produce food for people. And so we are on a totally slippery slope here, and typically people swimming in that stuff, you can imagine what happens to their health. There's cholera, there's typhoid, and so on. So that is definitely not a sustainable way of building cities. And here we are in London. Now, London has taken this a couple of stages further. You probably remember from history books about the great stink in London when in 1850 the MPs in the House of Parliament were so inundated by the smells of the Thames that they had to stop debating, and when they stopped debating they decided to make a decision about this problem. And the decision was to build a great sewer pipe. The Basel Gate was commissioned to put this pipe in the embankment to basically separate people from their waste. Of course, there was also cholera at the time. Big problem. So most of the stuff now goes to Beckton Sewage Works, which is just down the Thames. And from there, it's taken in freighters to the North Sea. Now, it's no longer allowed to do that. The European Union has decided that this is not a good idea. So what they are now doing instead, would you believe it, is build two gigantic incinerators to burn all our waste and turn it into energy, or some energy. And so instead of putting the fertility contained in it on the land, they're putting it into the atmosphere now instead. Sorry, that's gone too fast. Now, this is a nice little new factory which was built in Aberporth in Wales, and it actually contains a fascinating technology, which is a membrane technology. Basically, what this little factory does is to separate water from its impurities, simply using very high-tech, very up-to-date membrane separation technology. So this kind of sewage works, you could have dotted across our cities. You could concentrate the waste products that are carried by the water and do what they do in this next place here, which is in Bristol. This is Wessex Water in Bristol. Now, wrong way around here. It's actually not a brilliant slide, I'm afraid. It's a huge dryer. It's a slurry dryer. The waste of 600,000 Bristolian ends up as 10,000 tons of what they call biogram pellets. And these pellets are used then to do this. Well, first of all, they go into these bags. And then they go here, which is the landscape around Merthyr Tydfil in South Wales, just across the Severn. What they're doing with the stuff is actually resuscitating a former industrial landscape with the waste fertility of the city of Bristol. Now, imagine the city of Rio doing the same thing with their stuff, putting it back on the land in the Cerrado in Brazil, where they're growing soya beans for us now, or some other landscape where they might be producing food for themselves. At the present time, this type of circular process is beginning to be applied only by a few cities, but it's beginning to happen more and more, partly because it's realized that wherever flushing stuff into the sea ultimately does nobody any good at all. Now, this is another issue, the solid waste of our cities, another major output. In the case of London, 3.5 million tons of the stuff. Here we are in Mucking, very appropriate name, in Essex, which is a great hole in the ground where hundreds of thousands of tons, I think about over 1 million tons of this stuff is dumped every year. Now, look at this crazy mixture of stuff. Most of this can't really be beneficially reabsorbed into nature. So why don't we separate it? Well, this is car. This is the kind of the remnants of the charcoal smelted iron ore from Carajás mine. Thank God at least this stuff is being re-smelted into new iron and new steel, which is very important in terms of circularity, that I believe is so critically important for urban sustainability. Here are some recycling schemes, in this instance in Vienna. Now, the Viennese are in an interesting position because their city is run basically by a city authority. Wish we had one in London. Hope we'll have one soon. But secondly, they also have something called a city works, which London had about 500 years ago, but no longer has, because everything, of course, has been privatized. So in this instance, because you have a situation where the entire city, in terms of its energy management, in terms of its resource use, in terms of its waste management, is run by the city works, you have the relatively easy integration of different functions within that city. And so in this instance, they have got a variety of different containers. We have them in London now too, of course, that are used to separate waste so that we end up with something that is actually usable rather than something that is coagulated in the way we saw in Mucking there earlier on. In London, it is fair to say, this problem has now been looked at seriously, and I'm really pleased to hear that the LPAC, which is the London Planning Advisory Council, together with London Pride, a business organization, have been able to put in place a new plan for London's waste, which will be coming into action by the year 2000, where we do separate all our household waste, and recycling will create some 1,500 new jobs in this city. It's certainly a step in the right direction. Here's another nice initiative in London. This is up at the Edmonton Incinerator, where they don't incinerate everything that they get, but this is park waste from Hyde Park, chopped up branches, turned into compost. Instead of importing peat from somewhere outside London, like from Scotland or from Ireland, this stuff is used then in London gardens to grow flowers, maybe some vegetables and so on. A great, incredibly sensible initiative, and we are seeing a lot more of that in London as a result of the success of this type of initiative. Now, this is a related subject, which is urban agriculture. This is one of my hobby horses, so please, if I ride away on my hobby horse too fast, hold me back. It's something that is very dear to my heart, simply because in this thinking about the urban metabolism, I've come to realize that it really makes a great deal of sense to get food, at least a substantial proportion of it, from relatively close by. Now, London, Heathrow, the entire Heathrow Airport until about 50 years ago was one gigantic vegetable garden. This is one of the last remaining ones in Sunbury on the Thames. And this farmer, who we filmed with when we made the film on London Metropolis, said he could no longer compete with the beans and the Brussels sprouts and whatever else was being flown in the bellies of VA jumbo jets from Kenya. Well, it doesn't make sense. All that energy that is required to fly the stuff across halfway across the globe, you know, how come that this man cannot compete with that type of vegetable production, instead having to really battle to make a living from growing his leeks and his beans and whatever else? Just does not make sense. And I think many countries in the world are recognizing this now. Here now we are in New York. Oh God. And this lady is from Puerto Rico, and she lives in the Bronx. And until a few years ago, this was a bombed out area which had been burned down in some drug wars there. Until the local community got together with some officials from New York Botanical Gardens and said, New York Botanical Gardens had too much compost. These guys had wasteland, but no topsoil. So the two got together, and now right across the Bronx, you see these wonderful vegetable gardens. People, sometimes unemployed, certainly still quite closely attached to the land, are growing crops there for themselves, for their families. They're also community centers. They bring people back into a positive mode. And it's not only that kind of thing that you can see in New York. You can also see wonderful initiatives of farmers markets right across the city. And we really need a lot more of that in this country. Now, we have heard a lot in recent years about urban agriculture, including a fascinating study by the United Nations Development Program published for the Habitat Conference. And in that study, it was shown that certainly most of the cities in the poorer countries have a very vigorous urban agriculture, typically 60% of people actually growing crops in or around cities. Well, of course, we don't want to be compared with poor countries necessarily, but then the statistics from America show that in the last 10 years, the percentage of food grown in urban areas, in metropolitan areas, in the United States, went up from 30% of the total to 40%. 40% of the entire dollar value of food consumed in the States comes from urban areas and from the urban periphery. So I think we can learn from that. I mean, the United States so often is an example to us. Why not in this area? Why don't we do something about turning the 10% of the total land surface of London designated as farmland back into agricultural use and reduce the energy requirement of the urban food system dramatically in the process. Now, this is back in the Pearl River Delta in China, and of course the Chinese have been doing this very effectively for a long time. Most of the major cities in China are actually largely self-sufficient in food by growing crops in the periphery of their cities, and typically Shanghai, for instance. 20% of the land surface that it administers is actually built on. The rest of it is agricultural land area. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that this is directly applicable in a country such as the UK, but at least we can move in that general direction, while the Chinese, of course, are in the process of moving away from it. Because a lot of their land, unfortunately at this point in time, the agricultural land they use for building factories on. But that's another story. The critical issue is also how we can bring nature back into our immediate local environments. And a great deal of that is being done in ecological design initiatives right across Europe. Ecological design is really something that is catching on in a big way. And in my view, it is going to really be the kind of theme of architecture in the future. And I know that Richard Rogers, who is present in this room, would fully endorse this view. We have to start by looking at the potential of the ambient energies around our buildings and around our cities to become significant in the way we design these cities, in the way we design our buildings, making sure that solar energy can be come into full use into the way we operate and design the structures that we live in. Here we are now in a project in Germany where an ordinary row of council houses in a town called Essen has been simply kitted out with photovoltaic cells up there. And when you speak to the people in these houses, I just turned up one day and asked them, what is it like to live in a house that requires very little external energy input from fossil fuels, except in the coldest winter months? And people just had delightful and positive responses to the situation that they were sort of guinea pigs in, you know, being able to prove that in their own lives that it is possible to switch from total dependence on fossil fuels to something dramatically reducing that dependence by the utilization of intelligent new technologies. Now, this building, I'm pleased to say, is in the UK. It's up in Newcastle, and it's one of the largest solar-powered buildings in Europe at this point in time. Photovoltaics is still an expensive technology, and I'm not saying it's the only technology for urban energy supplies in the future, but it's of very considerable significance, because bringing together photovoltaics with combined heat and power systems and other leading-edge technologies will dramatically reduce the energy requirements of our cities and therefore the global environmental impacts of these urban structures. This is an apartment building in Notting Hill Gate, and it does raise an interesting... I mean, the one in Newcastle looked very similar when they started converting it and fitting these solar cells in that 1960s building. Of course, there is a problem with shading, ultimately, and one has to obviously reconcile the need for having trees in cities with the need to be able to put photovoltaic cells on buildings. So this is an issue that will have to be discussed again in a multidisciplinary way between architects, between solar engineers, and between tree surgeons. How can we make sure that we have compatibility for these various requirements? So coming to the end of my talk, the issue of the dominance of the cities in terms of their resource use has to be addressed at all kinds of different levels. And one level that hasn't been mentioned yet is the financial level. A city such as London, if you look at its economy, by definition, is a city concerned with banking, insurances, services in general. And Canary Wharf is the epitome of that. A huge concentration of financial and economic power in just that one single tower. These people here are dealing in energy futures in the London Petroleum Exchange. They are concerned with futures markets, future prices of energy. What they don't concern themselves with is the future impact of the use of that energy that they're trading here. And that is a critical issue, and I'm delighted to hear that increasingly the financial community is beginning to realize that business as usual just won't do any longer at an age when urbanization becomes so dominant and when the urban organism starts sprawling across the globe. And the point about the urban organism is that it is not self-sufficient in these streets, in these buildings here, but it has tentacles stretching right across the globe at this point in time. The critical issue is how we can reduce those tentacles, how we can reduce the ecological footprint of cities without becoming kind of parochial and becoming narrow-minded. I mean, we need to continue, I think, the cultural exchanges that are happening across the world and are happening in our inner city communities in this wonderful way here in the Portobello Road or in Goulburn Road, just near where I live, where you have the incredible coming together of expertise, of knowledge, of people's experience from so many different backgrounds. And that, in my view, is a critical feature of an urban future. but it's one that absolutely, definitely requires the exchanges of people, not only face to face, but also utilizing the latest technologies for internal communication within cities. This is a column which contains a few gadgets that allows people to express opinions about things in cities. I mean, rather like these milk machines on the banks where you can draw money, here you can press buttons and key in opinions about how you think your city is run and how you might improve the way it operates. We have amazing opportunities of using electronic technologies for improved urban communications, for better decision makings within cities, and ultimately for better understanding of the impacts of cities on the outside world. Cities will always be places where we trade, where we have beautiful things coming in from all over the world, but the critical issue is doing this in a responsible way, environmentally responsible, socially responsible, not leaving an increasing number of people in cities destitute with nowhere to sleep and nowhere to stay. And it's critically important, in my view, that we take culture, the theme of the exuberance of people's minds within cities, as of critical importance for future urban development. This being the Notting Hill Carnival, which I got involved with from the 60s. And it is wonderful to have seen this grow over the decades into something that is really truly a folk festival, where creativity expresses itself in the most extraordinary way. We cannot only think about sustainability purely from an environmental perspective. It has to bring together environmental, social, economic, and cultural in one coherent concept. And it's not ultimately only up to these guys there just telling us, running a city such as London. It's extraordinary that the people in that building, in Whitehall, still think that they can dominate and control a city so full of creativity, so full of exuberance. And I'm delighted to hear that sooner rather than later there's likely to be a new elected authority in the city that can institute many of these changes that I think are now long overdue in our cities. Thank you for listening.
Herbert, thank you very much, and for this world tour, both in span across and up and down through the cross-section of the earth. I think if you brought home one point, which I take away with me tonight, is that the environmental issue is a fundamentally social issue, and often this discussion gets divorced into two separate things. Now, it would be very good to have some questions from the floor. There are people with microphones. If you could just put your hand up and let me know. I think there's a question certainly over there. And if you could attract my attention, then the lady with a black jacket there.
The question relates to something that you began to touch on at the end. And it's really because I'm asking a question because I'm not entirely convinced about your idea of circular metabolism, because I think that when you talk about linear metabolism, what you're really talking about is the kind of internationalization of the world economy and world trade, which I think is the real mark of the modern age and has been an incredibly kind of progressive thing for humanity. And I think it's not just a question of kind of economics and how you get rid of your waste and so on. It's also kind of made all kinds of social forms of interaction possible. And I think just to name a few things that I think are really positive or which world trade has made possible, I think the kind of the end of parochialism, like you mentioned, associated with kind of medieval feudal towns, where that sort of suspicion of the people that lived kind of in the next town along, and the sort of international travel, mobility, the kind of swapping of cultures, which I think are all kind of inseparable from world trade and a kind of international division of labour. I think the other thing that I think has been made possible by that is the kind of cheapening of goods that we consume to the extent where people's standards of living has been incredibly kind of raised in the modern age. Now, I'm not an economist, so that's my kind of my view of it for, as a kind of a lay person, but I'm just wondering whether you think that a circular metabolism would also lead to a sort of reversion to like a pre-modern era, and a reversion to that sort of parochialism and fear of foreigners.
Yeah, happy to. Sure. I mean, it's a very, very important point you make. What I'm first of all concerned about is resource efficiency in cities, which, you know, as I was trying to emphasize throughout, are the places where we now live. Cheapness is often a function of inaccurate pricing, in my view, and I think we need to look at every type of product that we use in order to, you know, examine whether or not the price, you know, tells the full picture. When I showed you those fish in the North Sea, they are definitely underpriced because they are being fished out of the water and not, and the waters are not being replenished. There are certain key environmental aspects and limits to the way in which cities can simply take the world's resources without accounting for the impact of that. We are seeing the beginnings of environmental accountancy. I'm sure at the LSE as much as in other, certainly at the London Business School and London University, there's a lot of thinking going on now on environmental accounting. My concern is not, I mean, I believe world trade in itself, of course, has had an exciting contribution to make to our ways of life. However, I think the question is whether we can dematerialize that trade increasingly, because shipping sort of things from halfway around the world simply to then replace them with the things that we ship to other countries where those goods have come from does, in my view, not make sense. Some things, I believe, can be done much more locally than they're at the present time, and I think the question of food trade is certainly an important one. That doesn't mean, therefore, we're going to stop eating every single mango, avocado, whatever. It means, however, that we might possibly not fly in beans from Kenya, or flying in cherries in the winter from Chile or whatever. I think there's possibly limits to that. Maybe we can put things back in bottles from time to time again, like people used to. I don't think, by the way, that, you know, everything in history by definition is parochial and narrow-minded and so on. Don't forget, some of the most international people in the world were living in the Middle Ages. I mean, if you think of or even before that, I mean, Aristotle or Socrates or Leonardo da Vinci, those were not narrow people in any way whatsoever. I think we need to really seriously consider whether we need to dematerialize, this is a term that's being used quite a lot now, dematerialize our production system and also our trade. I think it makes a lot more sense to trade in ideas than in actual physical objects that have to be shipped across the globe, you know, using a huge quantity of fossil fuels. I think there's a really important point there. I mean, I haven't answered all your points, but I would love to come back.
More comments. I mean, one of the things that I'm looking through the audience for hands, which would be good to look at, is that you've raised a lot of issues to do with the micro scale of the city. We are faced, according to the Department of the Environment in this country, with 4.4 million new households to be built in Britain over the next 2 years. How do the issues you raise, how can they actually be built into our designs and creations for the new cities or the consolidation of the inner city? We'll come to that. But if we have two or three comments in a row, this gentleman with glasses, lady in black, and you over there. So start one, two, and three. Yes, you first. Hold on for the microphone.
About the economic system under which we live. I mean, right at the beginning of your lecture, you suggested that the problem perhaps was associated with the underpricing of energy, in suggesting that a different pricing system could lead to some kind of solution to the problem. It's a sort of an idea that's been thrown around. But we live in an economic system that in order for the large conglomerations of capital to survive, is constantly increasing the productivity of labour, is increasing constantly the rate in which it consumes raw materials natural resources and so on. And it seems to be quite inherent in the very character and nature of this economic system. It's a big question, but isn't there something fundamentally wrong with an economic system that requires, for example, 20% of the world's population to consume 85% of resources and get these commodities coming from all over the world, I mean, which we don't really need to consume. We don't need giant prawns and various other things that we see in our supermarkets today. I mean, how are you going to address that question? I mean, your ideas are very interesting, but I can't see an economic system like the one that we're existing in today even beginning to approach a solution to those problems.
Can we have a second question? Maybe that slip in the middle. Four rows back, five rows back.
I was wondering what you meant by incorporating a cultural element to sustainable cities.
A cultural element?
Referring to your conclusion.
Gentlemen, just a few rows further back. Yeah. Let's have your statement.
I'd like to, it's sort of a follow-up to the question posed by the gentleman. It's to do with implementation. As you say, energy pricing is a key consideration. And I just wondered if you'd given some thought to two bottlenecks that I perceive in the implementation of, as you say, rational energy pricing policy. One would have to be at the local level. You said that any sustainability or drive towards sustainability has to incorporate social sustainability. And there is currently a very perceived negative impact on equity and egalitarian issues by a rise in energy pricing. Mm-hmm. And that has severe political repercussions, as we saw over the VAT debate. The second bottleneck, I would say, would occur at the international level when you start to talk about energy taxation. If you take the example of the food that's shipped in, somehow or another you have to incorporate an energy tax so that it doesn't become profitable to import that food. If you try and incorporate that energy tax at the developing country level, there's going to be, again, there's an equity consideration, and there's also a lot of international bargaining negotiation that would have to have to surround that.
If, Herbert, you take the economic questions together and then the cultural.
I'll try that, yes. I mean, I have to emphasize that this talk was entitled Sustainable Cities, a Contradiction Terms? And so the main emphasis of the talk was on these resource use issues. And I personally am not an economist. That doesn't, however, mean that one can, in this context, and should not address these key economic issues, and I've certainly, in passing, tried to do so. Obviously, we are caught in the situation of an economic system that, by definition, thrives on exploitation of resources of people and everything, and has formulated policies to match that. I believe, and my hope is, that we are coming so rapidly up against the limitations of this system in terms of its own sustainability. That is my hope. I can't be certain that it's going to work out this way, but my hope is that, certainly, for instance, take the case of Lloyd's recently, where there were massive losses as a result mainly of reinsuring environmental risks. And Lloyd's was forced in the end, seeing these losses, to call in consultants from environmental groups. So one day, suddenly Lloyd's found itself at the same table as Greenpeace. And so there was a very energetic dialogue between experts on climate change coming in from outside and persuading Lloyd's that much of the storm damage that they had been having such massive losses as a result of was because of climate change and increased temperatures and coastal waters. I'm just raising this that, I mean, we are faced with the reality of an economic system that for the moment we seem to find impossible to shake off. And clearly the kind of competition between Eastern Europe and the rest of the world And the result of that has, for the moment, led us to think that, you know, a kind of planned economy is not possible, that the market is king. I am not, however, quite as convinced as that we are ultimately not going to benefit from the growing contradiction within the economic system, the bottlenecks that are building up at various levels, and ultimately the need to rethink our economic system in terms of the possibility of redefining economic priorities, firstly, and secondly, economic parameters under which we act. In terms of energy taxation, that is certainly beginning to happen. At the European level, for the moment, the European Union is still shying away from it, but we are already seeing the implementation of that in various countries, including in Denmark and in Sweden, partly for environmental reasons. We are running out of time. Well, the cultural issue, and I mean, just generally linking the environmental with these many other issues, I think is critically important in terms of what I try to emphasize, that the incredible possibility of exchange of ideas within cities between different cultural backgrounds is of critical importance ultimately for the social health of people in those cities. And I think the best examples of people from all over the world living together prove that. And certainly my experiences in Notting Hill over the last 30-odd years show that vigorous cultural interaction has an immensely positive social and beyond that even environmental effects. Openness of exchange of ideas, learning from each other is really what it's about in terms of achieving greater urban sustainability. So I can only once again reaffirm that this is my experience.
Thank you. I'm aware that it's nearly 6:40, so even though I know there are more questions up at the top, there is the great advantage today that we hope you'll all come upstairs to the senior common room and continue this discussion amongst yourselves or with Herbert. But I must say one of the challenges in a way of Herbert's talk in its sort of apparent simplicity sometimes is to throw back at us effectively a program of research, of interdisciplinary research, which I think is certainly possible here. Can I thank Herbert, but also thank the Alumni Environmental Initiatives Network for organizing this first lecture. I hope it's the first of many of this intensity. We'll go away certainly with new ideas and new thoughts, but mainly thank Herbert for an excellent lecture. Thank you very much.